Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you've seen the 2005 documentary Overcoming, which is about the CSC team, you may remember a scene with Carlos Sastre doing lactate tests up a mountain pass. At one point he sighs and admits, "I think my computer is cleverer than me." Well, 15 years on, it's not just our computers that are cleverer than us, it's most of the rest of our kit as well, including turbo trainers and now even helmets. On this edition, we hear from the people behind two of the most innovative brands, Sufferfest and POC Helmets. This is the Ruler Podcast, supported by Lacca, bicycle insurance powered by the community. Well, the weather in the UK recently has kept plenty of us inside on our turbos and our rollers, and I'm sure many of you will have been cursing some of the programmes designed by our next guests. All the way from Sufferlandria, it's Neil Henderson and Matt Cassin. Now, Neil, you, first of all, you're a former pro triathlete, coach to a lot of very well-known riders and athletes, and your title is Chief of Science at Sufferfest. What does the Chief of Science do?
Yeah, really I've been charged with bringing kind of a scientific perspective to how we train. We all know in cycling, there in racing is an element of suffering. And even when we go out and ride on our own on a weekend, not in a racing situation, sometimes the weather creates it. Sometimes a mountain creates it. Sometimes other riders that we're with create that suffering. There's a bit of tongue-in-cheek within the Sufferfest as it is. But with what we do in our training, we're really trying to make what you're able to do there on the bike more effective and enjoy that.
And Mac, you are Chief Cycling Physiologist, and you're also an elite track rider and still a road rider, I think. What's a Chief Cycling Physiologist?
Yeah, so my role is really about looking into, you know, kind of aggregate data from, you know, all the users we've had, and then taking people into our lab that we have set up in Boulder, testing them, looking at different, you know, if what we're seeing in larger data sets is replicable in the lab, and then producing new things from that. So one of the main ones that we've worked on is a new ramp fitness test. So that's going to be probably the first proper project to come out of the SUF science division.
And how does that differ from kind of existing tests?
That one's unique because the ramp stages, so it's a ramp to failure, which is pretty standard. Those stages will be based off of your maximal aerobic power, not off of FTP. So that eliminates some of the variation in terms of how far you can get in a ramp if you have a low FTP compared to high, you know, 1 minute power. And then there's also a heart rate constrained component afterwards. And so what we do there is we're able to essentially plot a low power, low heart rate interval before the constrained, take the heart rate and power from the constrained interval, and then take a portion of the ramp and the peak heart rate of the ramp, and you can basically make a linear regression, a nice straight line between those three points, and then get a really accurate estimation of FTP based off of where their threshold heart rate would fall on that line.
I'm just about following you, but that is very, very complicated, isn't it? Or at least, you know, is it simpler when you're actually sitting on the bike?
When you're sitting on the bike, it's very simple. It's a standard, especially if you're on a smart trainer that has erg control. It'll just take you the ramps until you can't go anymore. And then for the heart rate constraint, some people might find that difficult because very few people these days ride explicitly to heart rate. And so we just ask you to change your effort so your heart rate stays stable, which can be challenging. But even if you don't nail all those parts correctly, like the ramp portion will still give you an FTP and MAP. And specifically, because we have so much aggregate data looking at different age, gender, weight, that we can take the ramp values and add in factors, variables around your age, weight, gender to give a more accurate FTP. So instead of taking 75% of a peak 1 minute for everyone, we, you know, make the appropriate modifications.
Okay, is this part of four dimension power, or is it?
Yes, this is aligned with it. It is one where we're going to only be really calculating two of the values, so the max aerobic power value from the ramp and then the FTP calculated from the constrained portion. But from that data, then we're going to be able to target for somebody a little bit better estimate for their anaerobic capacity and neuromuscular power based on those factors, age, gender, weight, from that large data set that we have with all of our full frontal data, for somebody to be able to train using 4DP without having done that maximal 4DP test effort.
Okay, explain four-dimension power for those of us who still think that heart rate monitors are advanced.
Yes. So 4DP power is really something that we use to target training across a bigger range of intensities rather than just threshold. So threshold is an important value, and there's different names for that. And if you look in literature and things like that in the past, you might see something like lactate threshold or lactate threshold power, anaerobic threshold, or functional threshold power is kind of the term du jour now out of this sustainable power. But that's just one element. When we actually look at cycling, different types of events can be heavily reliant on different factors. So in track cycling, we have something like an individual pursuit that's going to be very well dictated by the power at VO2 max or max aerobic power. But there's still other components that we look at in cycling. The anaerobic capacity, the ability to go on and off way over threshold is very important, as well as like a true sprint or pure sprint, a neuromuscular power. So that 4DP is addressing all four of those values, with FTP being the lowest of those higher intensity domains.
So you're saying that two individuals with effectively the same maximum power output can be very different over different events, so sprinters or climbers, and therefore the training shouldn't be the same.
Correct. That's really our the biggest thing. So we could have 10 different people with the same FTP, 300 watts, and let's just say they're all, 80 kilos. So they have a certain power to weight ratio at that threshold, but you might have one of those individuals who can have a peak neuromuscular sprint power of over 2000 watts and another person who can't crack 800 watts on a sprint. And then all values kind of in between that. Same when we get into the anaerobic capacity, if we look at what they could do for maybe a minute type of effort, one of those individuals, again, could be upwards of 700, 800 watts for a minute, even with a 300 watt FTP, and somebody else who might just be able to eke out 450 watts for a minute. And so when we look at then the sum of all four of those and the variations, there is a really big variability across people, even if you had the same FTP. And as we do know, not everyone has the same FTP. So it's just like this massive range, and being able to target the training relative to your capacity in those different values helps us be more effective.
And you've been using this principle, presumably, with the pro athletes you work with. I mean, people like Rowan Dennis, Kashe Nwadona. What difference have you seen it making with them?
It's a tool, really. I kind of came to developing it back in around 2007 and 2008, working with Taylor Finney and getting him ready for the Beijing Olympics in the individual pursuit. I looked at, some of the different models and tools that were out there, and everything was based on a threshold, which Taylor had a very, minimal cycling background, literally a couple years in the sport, even though he was, competing at a very high level. He didn't have a massive background. And so looking at the power associated with an individual pursuit, it's much closer to that VO2 max value. And so we were targeting our training based on that. The values that we saw from some of these models just, looked like he was, training less than a 60-year-old master's rider as a coach. And I was like, well, this doesn't really make sense to me. And so really started to go down the road of looking at these different values that were much more important. And even, in track cycling, Taylor got into the kilo, the, you know, minute-ish event now, plus or minus, I guess, a second these days, dipping under a minute in some cases. But other riders as well worked with Sarah Hammer, who was switching from, you know, an individual pursuit focus to an Omnium focus for the London Olympics, and helping her evaluate where her strengths and weaknesses were and where she needed to develop as a rider and look across that continuum of abilities, because an Omnium definitely required a mix of abilities to have success. And so that kind of information we've been using for a while, and being able to continue to develop and craft that and develop workouts that target those different systems have been in play for a while, and we just keep getting a little bit better. And so I would say Rowan and Kasia are able to benefit from some of this work that we've been doing for a number of years.
Yeah, Rowan is a fascinating athlete, isn't he? It must be really interesting to work with.
For sure. So, I mean, I first, you know, probably met Rowan very briefly in 2008 at the Junior World Championships with Taylor, actually, in Cape Town, South Africa. And so in the final of the 3K and Junior World Championship individual pursuit in 2008, it was Taylor versus Rowan, and Taylor did come out on top of that one, and then continued on to the Olympics in the individual pursuit that year in 2008. And I got to know Rowan a little bit better in the coming years then, as I was working with both Taylor at the track, some of the World Cups and World Championships, and then our U.S. women's team. I continued on when Taylor moved to a bigger focus on the road. And so when Rowan finished his career in the track after London in 2012, you know, he contacted me about working with him to help him get that transition from track performance to being a higher performer on the road. And so way back in the fall of 2012, we started working together.
And what are the sort of particular differences between, you know, a really high level track rider and a road rider? What do you need to work on?
Yeah, there's a few things. So it depends a little bit on what the focus of the rider is going to be. So Rowan was looking a bit more time trial and even stage race focus. On the track, the longest event that he had done, typically, you know, team pursuit. He did some other races for sure, but, you know, a sub-4-minute event with extreme power demands and technical components, very, very important. And he also definitely had success in time trialing already. He had, you know, a silver medal as an under 23 at the World Championships in 2012. So definitely an accomplished rider, but being able to carry that from a U23 level on the road to success at the Pro Tour level is definitely a bit of a jump. You know, there's very few athletes that, you know, just make that jump very rapidly and quickly and easily. I mean, I guess these days, sometimes from now, we're seeing some riders kind of skip over the U23 and coming straight at it, which is quite an interesting situation. But, you know, Rowan had long-term goals, had tasted success at a very high level, you know, a silver medal at the 2012 Olympics, and he had hunger for more and has hunger for more. And so being able to help him develop and improve endurance and train the way a road rider does, with more repeated days of intensity and volume back to back, and building that kind of endurance is a multi-year process, really, to kind of maximize what's possible.
An extraordinary result in Yorkshire last year.
Yes.
Which presumably you were delighted with. And I heard an interview with him recently where he said that his kind of two targets, his only targets really for this year, are Worlds and Olympics, you know. And how does that kind of change the way that you work with an athlete?
Yeah, I mean, last year in Yorkshire was an amazing, amazing day. A hard lead in certain respects. Did not follow the typical path. Did not have any race days for 7 weeks.
Because he'd left his team during the Tour de France and really hadn't raced again since, had he?
Yep, so there weren't any racing opportunities there. So the training was done pretty much by and large by himself. We changed things up a little bit. Instead of some of the longer training blocks that we had used, we kind of shortened those down a little bit, but still had very, you know, specific intensity work being done, and still, you know, appropriate volume certain days, some long rides in there, because his goal, of course, was to repeat as the world champion in the individual time trial, which is a very, you know, massive task and the pressure that comes with that. And then again, in the situation of not having, you know, raced with the team and all the stuff that was coming with that, you know, added just another element of pressure and expectation, and to do basically anything other than win would have been a failure in certain respects. And so for him to be able to put together that performance on the day was kind of a magical, you know, result for him. And what he did and how he was able to keep everything together and perform.
And the other thing he's talking about, I'm not sure how seriously, is another crack at the world hour record.
We've had some discussions. The very first time when we talked about it, it was more honestly as a joke, I think. And then he said something, I believe, in media somewhere, talking about Jens Voigt's record being not that amazing or something to that effect. Like, I could do it. And I was like, well, you might have to back that up. And, you know, it did fortunately escalate. And it was actually an opportunity that we had looked at to improve his ability to, as an athlete and racer, and perform better. Like the 2014 World Championships, pacing was an issue. You know, he went hot after the second time check, went for it, and he blew up. He faded out and, you know, faded out of the medals there at that World Championship. And so being able to focus in on the hour was actually a lesson in learning how to pace and deliver that kind of effort over the entire duration, so over the hour. And that was definitely a fine success, and followed with some pretty amazing other race results, you know, the Tour Down Under, which happened before the hour record. But then the yellow jersey, the first stage at the Tour in Utrecht in 2015, was a pretty fantastic follow-up from that. And so the hour may play again a part in Rowan's future. And so, you know, we've been looking at different places where he could do that and what it's going to take with those scenarios, and how that preparation may come together. But first goals first with Tokyo and Switzerland.
Mac, the sort of advances in the way that people train, the way that, you know, people get better, particularly at an amateur level, has been quite extraordinary over the last 10 years. Do you think we've sort of reached a peak in our ability to transform people, or is there still a long way to go?
I definitely think there's still a long way to go. I think on the physiological side, in terms of training stimulus and understanding more about rest and, you know, what sort of training you should do in your time crunch, people are much more aware of what's going on, and there's lots of apps that now, you know, take care of that for you. I think there is still a massive part to be gained on the mental side, the psychology of training, of digging deep, of learning where your limits are, learning how to, you know, handle setbacks. That sort of thing is something that is expanding now, and I think is definitely going to continue to expand. And in 20 years' time, it's going to be, you know, just like heart rate monitors are now like, well, yeah, that's what you do. Like, obviously you use power, obviously you use heart rate. I think that component is going to be a foundation to training in the future.
You're listening to the Ruler podcast, supported by Lacca, bicycle insurance powered by the community.
I'm Mark Williamson, and I've been a Lacca customer since the start of 2019, so about 8 months now. So I was on this new bike and stopped off at a coffee shop at a hotel just to send a few emails and make a call. Came out and found someone had taken off the headset at the front. They'd cut the braking gear cables, they'd unscrewed the handlebars and stolen the bars and shifters. Lacca were phenomenal, actually. I was blown away by both the immediacy and the kind of helpfulness of the support. They seemed keen to help, and it was just a remarkably hassle-free experience. I couldn't have been happier with the service, despite being incredibly frustrated that somebody had decapitated my new bike.
Well, Ruler Desire editor Stuart Clapp is here. Stuart, are you a fan of the high-tech training methods?
Not in the slightest. Well, no, I am. I suppose if you're a pro cyclist, you need all that sort of stuff, right? Or they tell you you need it. Did Eddie Merckx have it? I don't know. He won a couple of races without having a power meter and all that stuff.
I think if power meters were available, Eddie would have had it, because he was all over the technology, wasn't he?
He was meticulous. I've seen a Sunday in Hell where he has his seat height measured every 10 minutes. Well, no, I'm not really. I've had power meters in the past, but do you know what? It sort of, I don't race anymore, and I just like riding my bike. I know when I'm going hard, and I know when I'm going like medium, and I know when I'm going easy. But actually, funny you say that. I've had pneumonia. I got a cold, end up with pneumonia. So I've started training again. Like started like riding my bike, say training, just riding my bike. And a couple of my mates have had the same sort of lurgies. And a couple of them have got back on and started riding again. No heart rate monitor, but are going purely on power. It's cracking them because obviously they've been off the bike. They're not hitting their numbers that they're supposed to be doing. And obviously they're working really hard to hit those numbers and then putting themselves in a box. So I've been using my heart rate monitor inside now because I've given up trying to ride outside. When you're not well, riding easy is all right, providing there's not a gale going on outside. Because one way, it'll be really easy. The other way, you'll be in zone five. I started riding my rollers inside and everything, and I've been using my heart rate monitor again. And that is like a true test. So I suppose if you are going to have all the info available, you need it all. You can't just have power. You've got to have heart rate as well. Or otherwise, especially if you're recovering from something like an injury or an illness or something, but, you know, and you need to see how fit you do. Suppose, you know, you're going to do 300 watts 1 week, you'll be doing it in zone four. And when you're getting fitter, you'll be able to do 300 watts in zone three. That's unlikely, but, you know, you would.
I think that's what Neil and Mac were saying, that you can't just rely on a single number or set of numbers. You've actually got to look at all what your body is doing as a whole. The other area where technology is really making a difference is helmets and safety, isn't it? And you've been riding the POC helmet which kind of collects data.
It's the POC ventral air, but it has the twice me. It's got a device in it basically, which is a safety feature rather than sort of like performance. And hopefully I'll never, ever use it. It's got this chip in it that you can sort of like download an app to a smartphone and you can touch it. And on it, it will have your medical details like blood group, everything else, like eye color and things like that, like distinguishing your like features. So if you're unconscious and a paramedic finds you, providing they have the app, which will be sort of, I actually ran into a couple of paramedics in the cafe when I was riding a little while ago, and I showed them the helmet and I was like, what do you think of this? And they said, that's great. We just need to know what the app is. So then if we see that logo, which almost looks like a Wi-Fi thing on the side of a helmet, they can scan it and it'll have everything in there. Because they were saying that, you know, if they find an unconscious cyclist on the side of the road, they don't particularly want to move them because they don't know how they've got there. So yeah, it's a really cool bit of kit, especially if you ride on your own, because I ride on my own quite a lot. Like I spoke to Damien from POC. Damien is he's the coolest guy ever. Damien was sort of saying, it's like, we want this helmet to speak for you when you can't. And it's like, that's kind of what this helmet's about. So yeah, there's a lot of really, really cool stuff out there. But I think we spoke to the guys, didn't we, when we were back at the Rulo Classic in November.
Yeah, do you remember we talked to Frederick and Magnus from POC and Gustav from a company called Exiger, and they work in light charging panels and what they're doing as well. Yeah, helmets that if you wear them in just ambient light, they generate an electric charge. The conversation started with us talking about that first POC road helmet design, which was a bit of a game changer, wasn't it?
Our take on the road bike helmet had to be all about safety, but to be a professional a helmet for the professionals, it also needed to be very light and very ventilated. These three ingredients was non-negotiable, so less than 200 grams and the most ventilated and the safest helmet on the market was the aim with the project.
And it looked different. Was there some sort of resistance at first? Did people look at it and think, actually, that's not what we expect from a high-performance helmet?
I guess. I'm actually not a road bike cyclist myself. I'm a skier and a mountain biker and surfer and so on, but not road bike. And my engineering mind was maybe not in tune with the road bike helmet at that time. So this is actually, the result is more or less what happened in my mind, trying to solve this equation in the best way.
And what was the key difference in the sort of approach to head safety, if you like, to brain safety, that led to the design of this helmet?
We wanted it to be more safe, have more coverage, especially in the back of the head. Helmets was really high in the back of the head, leaving big parts of the head unprotected. And same in the temple areas, which is actually a very sensitive area of your brain. So we really wanted to make sure to protect these parts of the head as well in the most efficient way. So in the end, it's a bit polarizing because it is wider and bulkier than helmet was at the time. But for us, safety and other performance like ventilation and the low weight was the most important thing. So yes, it ended up a bit different from other helmets.
But now it actually looks quite familiar, doesn't it? Now, you know, a lot of other
I guess
helmets
people
look similar.
It's more used to it.
Yeah. Stuart, you're a fan of Polk,
yeah,
aren't you?
I love this. Well, I was actually at the Tour de France the year Ryder wore the DIDS. I think Garmin were riding with Giro at the time. And I said to one of the guys, and I was like, so when are Pop going to do a road helmet? And they're like, well, don't talk about that. We've talked about it in the past and how you had a mood board behind and you took reference from old style helmets, like de Vlaeminck and a hairnet helmet, because those stripes were sort of reminded me of those. It's actually like, although it was really modern, it had like a nod to like the classic golden age of cycling, which is what I kind of got straight away. But it was such a divisive helmet, but like people were either loved it or hated it when it came out. Like, I don't get it because it looks so different. But now we see it, as you were saying, Ian, and it's, I don't know, it's rare that you get excited about a bit of like safety equipment. But the thing when you look at POC and how you look at brands, I think people have started to look at brands so differently now, where there's a lot of good stuff out there. POC, you know, you've led a lot of, as we're going to talk about in a minute, with the sort of the tech behind this helmet that you're holding, that you're buying something that you have an affinity with, the brand, rather than like the products. Like, he's a POC guy, he's a Giro guy, you know, it's like that. But yeah, this helmet's really interesting because, do you want to tell us a bit about this, like the materials you're using it? Because that was quite mind-bending. It's actually, I feel like I'm living in the future.
The future stuff, absolutely.
Yeah, tell us about the future stuff.
So we recently released that we are doing a cooperation. I am from Exeger, together with POC, to bring out the next generation of self-powered smart helmets. So what we have done is that we have developed a new material. It's a light charging material. Basically, it's a solar cell that works in any light condition, from artificial light to direct sunlight, that can be seamlessly integrated into any device thanks to its unique design capabilities. So these cells can be produced in any shape, in different textures, etc. So the cell becomes a natural part of, for instance, the helmet or these headphones. So this is an enabling technology where we bring a power budget to designers and producers like POC, to be able to take their products to the next level, bring smartness, bring increased functionality without affecting the aesthetics. Because we all know that, why do we buy stuff? Because you look cool, because you have nice functionality. And you can't increase the functionality on the cost of the looks.
So just to be clear, get this material and it charges under natural light or artificial light. And then if you have, say, lights on your helmet or you have headphones which need power, then you never actually need to plug it in and charge it. Is that right?
It's down to how you use it. I mean, if you're outside all the time, of course, it's quite easy to calculate, depending on what kind of stuff you put in there. But what we can do also is to put in new kind of sensors into, say, helmets. So we have impact sensors, G-Shock sensors, which will also, in case of a crash, give you immediate information how severe was this crash. But it will also be able to bring back information to producers like POC, who are quite proactive in safety and security, to give them information what happens before and during a crash, and that will help them, together with us, bring out the next generation helmets, which will be even safer for the users.
So the helmets you're actually wearing add to the research for future models?
It collects data for us so after a crash, we can study the helmet and how it physically is damaged from the crash and draw our conclusions from that. But we can also see how much force the crash gave to the helmet and you know, therefore to the brain.
So it feels like we're in the future already. What's the next step then? What's the next thing in helmet safety in particular?
With this technology, we are able to know more about real life crashes. We know a lot about testing helmets and to, you know, fulfill those standards that are required for us to pass. But helmets from, for example, our Protor team, we collect all those helmets that's been involved in the crash. We take part of information from the riders, if they had concussions or not, and then try to draw conclusions on how we could make their next generation helmet better, more efficient.
And that's it from this podcast. Don't forget the Ruler Long Reads podcast next week. Soon after that, I'll be reporting from Belgium for the opening of the classic season.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.